Hello, Blenders, and welcome to Real Blend episode number 76, the shot-for-shot live-action remake of episode number 75.
That's,
my name is...
What? That's a bad comparison. We have souls.
But the Lion King joke. Oh, you
know
it's
a Lion King joke.
It's true, we do have souls. Kevin will defend Lion King later on in the show. Hello, everybody. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at Cinema Blend. I am joined, as always, in the Real Blend family by my two handsome, intelligent, charismatic, and blessed by Tarantino co-hosts, starting with Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Kevin, how are you, sir?
Yeah, Sean, we live in a post-Tarantino interview world here.
Right.
It's pretty insane. So, I'm not going to lie. It's pretty insane. Sorry.
It is a little bit strange. If everybody knew how often we texted the same photographs back and forth to each other, it's not a different photo. It's just the same picture.
A couple times a day.
Accompanied with the caption, "Can you believe this?"
Right, like as if we were afraid one of the four of us forgot it for a second. That other voice is Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, say hello because Gabe won't.
Oh, hey, we got him on the last episode. That was almost as big of an exclusive interview as Tarantino.
You had to jam a microphone in his face to get him to answer. It was. I want to comment on this again because I listened back to last week's episode and it was odd to address Gabe sitting in the room with us and have him not answer, like just not reply. It's not how communication works.
But people don't understand that even though Gabe was in the room, he was actually producing a Hero Blend episode while we were doing a Real Blend episode. So, like, he would be rapping another host, and we were like, "Gabe, we just started talking about this topic 2 seconds ago." It was really weird.
Well, across the blend of Real Blend and Hero Blend, our guest this week, not Tarantino, as much as we talk about Quentin, Tarantino, the full Tarantino interview will be on next week's episode, number 77, which we have agreed to drop on July 25th. So circle that date on your calendar. However, it's not like we're slacking in any way, shape, or form, because later on in this episode, we will have Marvel president Kevin Feige joining the show, an interview that we conducted while part of the...
Oh, God, I loved being a part of the...
The Spider-Man Far From Home junket.
Kevin, did you enjoy being a part of that interview?
Wait, is this the same interview that it took Gabe a month to confirm, to actually approve it?
Well, to his credit, he was finding a hard time slotting it in amongst all the other huge names that we had.
But I'm a little concerned, though. I mean, I really want Quentin Tarantino on the show next week. Gabe, right. I mean, I want to make sure you're going to approve this. I mean, I'm just a little concerned.
He's doing that. Maybe.
Do you think that that joke is old to Gabe, or was it just never funny?
It's still funny, actually. Yeah, the third option.
All right, we're going to start with reviews, as we always do. If you guys send us a review, we are proud to read it at the top of the show. There are multiple ways that you can do it. There are multiple ways that you can send us a review. Gabe, fix that in post.
Hey guys, producer Gabe here. Just wanted to hop on real quick so that I could tell Sean no.
You can email it to us at realblend@cinemablend.com. That will reach us. This first one that I'm about to read came that way. You can also go to our iTunes page and leave us a review. We're up to 118 star ratings, and I think we have 65 written reviews. But this one in particular came to us via email, and it's from Previn Naidu. I'm going to say Previn Naidu. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, but it's from South Africa. And he says, "Hi guys, I would like to thank you for a great show. I've been following the podcast from day one and it's better and better every week. I love your insights into the world of movies and enjoy how you guys approach setting up interviews and junkets. You guys really make us feel a part of the conversation, and that's what makes this podcast so special. Three friends hanging out and talking about movies. With lots of love from sunny South Africa. Since I'm in Africa, I have to end by saying Wakanda forever." Which is that's the perfect way to end a review from South Africa. So I sent him back a sweet graphic of Black Panther doing the Wakanda forever I saw. And he wrote me back and said he appreciated it. Now we're pen pals. So my friend, Previn from South Africa. Our second one was posted on the iTunes page, and it is from someone that we all know very closely from the junket world, Tara Hitchcock.
Tara!
Who who has been friends with the guys forever.
Tara was at my wedding.
Better than I have.
Yeah.
And she's going to mention this in the review, actually. She says, her subject line is an apologetic friend. And she says, yes, I'm starting my review with an apology, and I'm sorry for not listening sooner and not weighing in earlier. I've known Kevin and Jake for years, and she's just getting to know me more recently, and I've been privy to Kevin's goofy puns, nervous pre-interview moments, and encounters with his cinematic idols for years. Mm. She adds, heck, I even think I witnessed his first marital spat hours after his I do's over late delivered Taco Bell for the wedding party.
This is true.
It's very true. Yeah. Taco Bell's fault, obviously. She says, it was not Taco Bell's fault?
No, there was a mix-up in communication. Like, I thought the food wasn't there, but the food was there. And for people who don't know, Taco Bell was delivered to my wedding. It's my favorite
fast
food.
And it was awesome.
It was amazing. My wife and I had our first date at Taco Bell.
It was great. I loved
You guys, guess what? I'm going to the Taco Bell Hotel in Palm
Where
Springs.
Where is the Taco Bell Hotel?
In Palm Springs. They opened up a Taco Bell Hotel for like a couple weeks. I'm actually going. I have a room. I have a room at Taco Bell Hotel on August 8th, I think.
Is it called a Hobel?
That would be amazing. The one thing I'm excited about really is
Jake, stop it. That was good.
They have hot sauce floaties in their pool. I can't wait to see this. Anyways, continue.
I just picture Sean lying in bed at night around 2 a.m. and just going, Hobel.
Taco Hobel. Come on, that's funny.
I think it's funny.
Jake, she says with two question marks, I've admired his sense of style, well thought out questions, and endless attempts to get Anne Hathaway and others to take him up on his fold out couch offer in his Houston, now Chicago digs for about a decade. Well, that's good timing because we're playing Anne Hathaway blend later on in the show. But anyway, sadly, says Tara Hitchcock, this is a long one, but I think it's worth reading. I didn't listen to the Real Blend podcast for a while because I figured that I see these guys enough already and usually overhear their thoughts on
films.
She's
sick of us.
After our junket screenings, I regret that move with an exclamation point. I've loved every episode and still haven't caught up as I'm now backtracking to make sure I listen to each one. Sean, I'm a parent also, and it moves me when you weigh in from that perspective, whether it's reviewing a film or sharing your movie watching experiences with your boys. Kevin and Jake and Sean, I'm so proud of you guys. Love the friendship and enthusiasm and knowledge you all share weekly on this show. It's funny, witty, respectful, educational, all at the same time. More importantly, it's a reminder that if you're not doing what you love with people whom you love, then what's the point? If you're a movie fan and you don't listen to Real Blend, you are missing out. My only hope is that one day Sean, or maybe I should direct this to Gabe, will let me join for a few moments, if for no other reason than to share the story of Kevin and Jake and glamping at the Jurassic World junket.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good story.
Jake and I decided to share a camping site on Kualoa Ranch where they shot Jurassic Park, as one does, right?
Yeah, that's a sentence that you are allowed to say.
Yeah, right. I can't believe that's actually a sentence.
And there was an available tent for everyone to have there. Oh, not just a tent. Where, like, it was true glamping, where like it was almost a mansion inside of a tent.
I don't know what glamping is. What is glamping?
Glamorous camping.
Gotcha. Okay.
And there was a tent for every person who wanted it. And Kevin and I chose, we like almost shoved everyone aside, not so that we could go get the best tent, but we could find the one tent with two twin beds so that we could tent and camp together. So that's the story that she's
telling.
And
I will say there's a GIF that we talk about often on the show, and it's Conan O'Brien looking through the glass.
Yes.
And I woke up, I can remember specifically waking up the next morning and going on Instagram and seeing the photos of you guys in the tent and I did the Conan O'Brien. We have moments throughout the course of Real Blend history where one of us is doing something so cool and the other ones are left out, and that was one of my moments.
Allow me to anger Gabe this early in the show. Did you guys see the video where Conan O'Brien got canceled on by Kumail Nanjiani? Seriously, did you guys see this?
I heard about it. I read like headlines, but I didn't see any video of it.
All right, I'll keep this vague then. Just go to Twitter, go to Conan's Twitter account. Essentially, 30 minutes before Conan O'Brien's taping of his show, Kumail Nanjiani had to cancel. So Conan comes out and does this monologue, essentially saying, I have no idea what we're going to do in our show tonight because our guest canceled. So he It's insane. So basically, from what I understand, Kumail was shooting something. I want to, maybe it's Silicon Valley. I don't remember what show it was. And he wasn't able to get out of the shoot in time to make it to Conan's show. So it is real. Like, Conan actually had to improvise a show without a guest. And then, so back and forth now, him and Kumail have been going back and forth. No, they're not mad. He's not even mad. Conan actually had Kumail on his podcast today in a friendly manner to explain the situation, because I think Kumail was getting, like, backlash. People were, like, saying that he canceled on Conan, but it was actually a work-related problem. He couldn't get out.
Well, it's funny. Like, people like Carson and Leno used to have go-to, like, standby guests who lived local and could just come on and tell stories for just
30 minutes before. This is 30 minutes before the show taped.
Oh, that's crazy.
I mean, think about how close that is to the taping. It's like insane. So it's amazing. If you go out, go to Conan's Twitter, just watch his opening monologue. It's actually pretty amazing how he did it really well. He did a good job.
Well, to get back on track, I want to thank Tara for that amazing review. Yeah,
that was really
thanks,
nice.
Tara.
And for listening. Thank you so much. And for spreading the gospel, because as we say, our greatest marketing tactic is listeners spreading the word of the show. And I've even seen on social a good amount of people who maybe started following us because we've been sort of dropping Tarantino hints on the Real Blend account. We picked up a lot of followers. But it's not just that. I've seen people who then say, oh, I've started listening to this podcast and it's actually pretty good. If you guys like movies, you should follow along. And so that's always great. And then what I love is we've got like this unofficial welcoming committee of a group of people who have been to meetups and such that they'll automatically get on and start like greeting new people to the Blender family. And again, it's showing to a certain extent that some of this is out of our control. Like we do the episodes and you guys meet on your own and have your own conversations and sometimes loop us in. And we're just glad to keep fostering the lines of conversation. And so
I just find it weird. My mom goes to meetups and doesn't tell me about it. Like she'll just go to like a Real Blend meetup and then not say anything to me. And I'm like,
sponsors.
Like, she'll send me selfies. I'm like, what's going on here, mom?
All right. News. The Kingsman trailer dropped earlier today. We were recording on a Monday. This is Matthew Vaughn's return to the franchise in a prequel. And I thought it looked pretty good. I'm pretty impressed with how it's going. My big concern about that trailer going into it was how are they going to do the gadget-heavy Kingsman franchise in a World War I period setting. And so it was scaled back just enough for me to appreciate that that approach is going to hamper or restrict Vaughn in a certain extent. Like, in a creative way, right? Like, he's going to have to get creative in terms of what he can do because it can't be overblown, over-the-top James Bond gadgetry stuff, which I thought derailed the second one where, like, mechanical dogs were chasing after Elton John and it got way campy. And so I kind of do want to see him strip it down and get back to the bare bones basics of it. Kevin, I'm going to go to you because you didn't care for it all that much. You liked it, but you said you were done. You're done with this franchise.
Well, it dropped and I had no immediacy to go watch. I first of all, I love Matthew Vaughn. I think Kingsman 1 is incredible. Kingsman 2 was kind of a disaster. I mean, there was some really cool action scenes in that film, but overall, I just felt that it just wasn't really a good story, right? I mean, the opening sequence in the taxi cab is amazing. Some of the action's good. I thought Elton John was a little out of place because it felt like I was watching Elton John. And even though he's playing Elton John, it just kind of stuck out to me. This film, I just don't understand why we need it. I mean, here's the thing. You could say that about a lot of things. You say it about Lion King if you want to. I don't care. I just don't feel the necessary urge to go out and see The Kingsman. I mean, I think that Kingsman 2 had my interest because I loved Kingsman 1.
Yeah.
I don't know that I care enough about this story to go back and live in it. I don't know. I just don't know. I didn't find the trailer to be really that engaging. Some of the action shots were cool. The blowaway shot when he goes out of the house into the World War, the setting, whatever it was, that was pretty cool. I don't know.
I got a little bit of goosebumps seeing the clothing store for the first time when they pulled up to the curb and we stood in front of the glass.
See, that's interesting. That's the part of the trailer I did not like.
Me too. Oh, really? I thought that was cheesy.
Yeah.
I thought that was cheesy too.
Really dug the first half of the trailer because I love this idea of going back and finding the origins in war, because Kingsman is such like a clean, pristine organization, so that its origins could be from a dirty, grungy, violent, bloody place. I find it to be very interesting.
Right.
But then the trailer ended up sort of just falling into what seemed like the plot of the first movie, which is a more distinguished man kind of helping out a younger guy. And kind of like, I was like, oh, is that what it's going to be? Like the first half. And I also don't know, did I really like the first half of the trailer or did I just love the music edited well with the bullets? And, you know, it was a very well cut trailer. And it's probably not going to be like that in the movie. And I responded to that part really well. And then my first thought was, well, that's trailer editing. That's not what it's going to be like in the movie. So I don't really know how I feel about this movie yet.
To your point that once we finished the last episode of season 3 of Stranger Things, not to divert season 3, I'm making a point here, Gabe, I promise. We watched the Bob O'Reilly trailer for the full season. Such an amazing trailer.
Like, a better trailer than a season.
Oh my God, it's so great how the music lines up with the imagery in that trailer. I thought that was fantastic. Now, what if the shot of them standing in front of the clothing store is the very last shot in the movie?
Then I'll be pissed if they put it in the trailer.
Really? But yes. You won't know until you get there.
I know, but then it'll annoy me.
What was the movie we saw recently where...
Never that's mind. Been happening where the last shot's been well, in the trailer.
That's what I was getting at. I couldn't remember.
I'll pull out The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Mark Webb, you know, ends his trailer with Spider-Man swinging the hubcap at the rhino, and that ends up being the very last shot.
Wait, doesn't Spider-Man Far From Home end on the last trailer shot?
When the last, not the last trailer.
Them swinging. Yeah,
but there were TV spots for Shazam that had the post-credit scene. There were TV spots that used the Aquaman joke.
That's right. Yeah.
Which I remember thinking, like, that's a post-credit scene.
That's because they were banking off the Aquaman box office. I mean, I get it from a business standpoint, but that's why would you give that away?
I saw the commercials for the home video release, and they're giving away the family, the transition of the family.
No,
I won't even say any more than that. But they showed that in the trailer, and I was very disappointed in that. All right, so Kingsman will be out in theaters in February of 2020. We'll see where Matthew Vaughn takes that franchise from here. This is a project that is number one with a bullet for Real Blend family members. Wait a second. Hold on. Now I clicked the link.
While you're looking for that, by the way, I do want to say.
Oh, my God. Wait, but I clicked it and it got updated with I just see a new name. OK, Kevin, I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that I'm still excited about what Matthew Vaughn's going to do. I'm just not as intrigued by this particular story. So we'll see what happens.
Fair enough. OK, so Deadline has a story today that Damien Chazelle has a new script.
Oh, I know what you're talking. Yeah, I know what you're getting excited about.
Wait, what is it? What's the
movie called Babylon.
Yep.
Right.
They're reporting it is a drama that mixes real and fictional characters, is solidly in the R-rated category. I don't know why that matters. It's set in, let's see, hold on. I want to see the description. A project described to me as an original drama that is set in period Hollywood at a shifting moment when the business was turning from silence to the talkies. Its sources said the film is a bold auteur piece with a significant budget and that other studios are in the mix. Rumor was that Chazelle had written another musical, but I'm told that is not the case here. When the first reports came out, Emma Stone was circling a role in it.
And did you also see that Clint Booth is actually circling around it as well?
That is once I clicked on this headline, I saw his name at the front. Brad Pitt apparently is looking at joining Babylon by Damien Chazelle. So that's Chazelle working on an original drama, not a musical, about golden age of Hollywood when the talkies are arriving and the silent film is disappearing. And he potentially is putting Brad Pitt and Emma Stone into the mix. So yes, please. Yes. that would be great. Thank
I just
you.
And as my much ticket, as actually. Listen,
you guys know First Man didn't work for me. You guys liked it more than I did, but that does not mean I'm off the Damien Chazelle bandwagon because Whiplash and La La Land were my number ones the years that they came out. And so I'm going to put that on the list of movies that we will hype to no end until it is officially here.
Sean, when will you understand that First Man is his masterpiece?
What? No, stop. What?
Yeah,
no.
When will you understand that? But it is. It actually is his masterpiece.
I love that movie. It was my number three last year. It's not his masterpiece.
It's his masterpiece.
You think it's better than La La Land and Whiplash?
It's his best movie. No. And no question.
Are you guys going to rewatch it this weekend?
Which one? What?
First Man. It's the this weekend is the 50th anniversary.
I will if I'm having trouble falling asleep.
You're insane, man.
You know what? You know what? You go to hell.
You know what? First Man is so
brilliant.
You know,
I tried to bring us all together for like an understanding, like it's a milestone in history.
Right.
No, you know what?
You prevented me from making my first La La Land pun. I was going to do first La La Land, but instead I went with the sleeping.
First La La Man? Is that what you're going to do?
Something like that, yeah.
First La La Man.
Dude, Kevin didn't even like that one.
Part of the reason why we're recording on Monday night is because tomorrow I'm leaving for San Diego and I will be
at
Comic-Con for the rest of the week. And Comic-Con is becoming it's shifting with every passing year into more of a television festival. But I want to just briefly talk about the three movie projects that will be down there and gauge your interests in all of them. Andy Muschietti is going to be appearing at Scare Diego and bringing more footage of It Chapter 2. And we've talked about this, obviously. We're fans of the first movie. We love the casting.
A new trailer should be dropping soon, right? I mean, the movie's like 2 months from coming out?
I would imagine because that first trailer that arrived was really just a long scene.
I actually saw Crawl the other night on Friday, and that trailer came on, and it's such an amazing trailer. I was talking about my wife actually made a great point. She's like, why don't more movies do full scenes like that at the beginning of a trailer? Right. I think it's a really good
Remember the movie Black Mass did something similar. It wasn't a great movie, but it was a great trailer. This super tense scene of Johnny Depp playing, I forget the name of the gangster that he played. Whitey.
Whitey Bulger?
Whitey Bulger. And it's just like that, a long scene at a table where he turns on somebody, and it's great. Cool. It's like Kevin said, it's super effective.
But like sitting in that theater watching Crawl and that trailer hits and everybody's immediately glued to it. Like you're like, it's like you're in the middle of a movie, right? Like that's how good the trailer is. And then watching that in a theater for the first time, it was my first time seeing that trailer in a theater. when she runs, like when she's like, the old lady's like naked in the hallway, like, run, I mean, it is ridiculously scary. It's like a ridiculous.
And you know what's really funny about that? There's nothing, horror about it. Like, what's unnerving about someone at the end of a hall all of a sudden moving very quickly out of frame? You know, well, it's just the stupidest thing, well, but it works.
Isn't she his daughter? Isn't she the clown's daughter? The old lady?
The clown's been around for generations.
Wait a second. In the movie, in the trailer, she looks up at a picture on the wall and says,
I think you're listening to that too closely.
The clown is just in a picture, but the clown has been around for an eternity. It's not like the clown has a family.
Yeah, it's not like the clown is human.
Yeah.
Was the clown ever human? We don't know that for sure.
I don't think the clown
was
ever human.
Do you know that for sure, Jake?
I mean, in the book, Sean, you've read it too. Like,
I've not read the book.
It's not a thing, it's a force.
It's like an interdimensional being.
Yeah. Bill Skarsgård is in a picture on her wall.
You're thinking too much about that.
Wait, you're taking
it too literally.
There's no thinking here. I'm talking about visually. They show you a photo on the wall that is Bill Skarsgård while the old lady is saying something about a father or something, right?
My father.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. Okay, but I think you're taking it too literally.
I'm not taking it too literally. I'm telling you what the trailer is visually showing.
Yeah, I saw it.
Okay, that's all I'm saying. I haven't read the book, and I don't know.
Well, also, like, there's, but when the I forget the name of the kid, when the kid's in the library in part one,
Ben,
he sees Pennywise in the
book
too.
In all the spots in Derry history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But the thing about you can do a trailer that's just a long scene for a sequel that people are dialed in for anyway. You know, like, you're not, I don't know if you're necessarily winning new people over to It Chapter 2. I think the people who came in the first one are going to come see the second one. You know, like, they're in. They're on board. So, It Chapter 2 is coming. Terminator Dark Fate is bringing footage to San Diego Comic-Con. We have discussed on the show that we're all kind of still waiting to be impressed by this. But let me ask this, then, of you guys. If a trailer or footage package comes out of Comic-Con and it looks really great, are you guys on the on the position where you can be swung back over to, oh, all right. Okay, Dark Fate. I'm ready to see what you're... No? Jake, you're out?
Nah. I don't know. It's because I think I've seen too many great trailers come out of Comic-Con that yielded crap movies.
Yeah. Suicide Squad?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Perfect example.
That trailer was a home run.
I'd be kind of impressed if Terminator could turn around what was, I think, one of the worst trailers to come out in the last year. I mean, whenever I see that movie pop up in the movie theaters, I think it came on before I went and saw Godzilla. And I remember thinking, like, maybe I could go pee right now. Like, that's how badly I
the
did not.
The song is so bad. The song in that trailer.
It's so bad.
It was on before Crawl as well. That was like, I remember seeing that trailer again, and it's like embarrassingly bad. And here's the thing. Terminator 2 is my favorite movie ever made. My favorite, my personal favorite film ever made. That and True Romance, right? So I love the idea of a film deleting all the sequels and becoming the direct sequel to Terminator 2. Though I will say this, I do love Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. I don't care what anyone says.
Good. Do you? You love it?
I love that movie. L-O-V-E. Love that film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. I like it.
I've seen it.
It's not Terminator 2 or 1, but I still loved it. It was satisfactory to me. It made me happy as a Terminator fan.
In a way that I love Live Free or Die Hard.
Right.
I do like, yeah. I like.
I love Live Free or Die Hard. I love
but
Live Free or Die Hard.
But it's never going to be the first one.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a good Die Hard movie. Yes.
But that being said, I'm very disappointed in the new trailer. There are two things that are keeping me on the fence. Tim Miller, who I think is a phenomenal filmmaker. I'm very excited to see what he does. I think his directing and visual effects are very well done. He comes from a visual effects background, so I'm excited to see what he does.
Okay, let me pause you right there. I think we're going to find out how much of the first Deadpool was Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick.
100%.
And Ryan Reynolds.
Yes, 100%.
Versus Tim Miller. I think this will answer that.
How much credit do you really want to give Tim Miller?
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
But see, I would argue that Tim Miller did a great job with the budget and the effects on Deadpool 1. It was whatever that movie cost was like $50 million or it was less than that, right? Something absurdly cheap for a superhero movie, and it looked really good. That opening credit slow motion sequence, the fighting sequences. I mean, Tim Miller, in my opinion, gets credit for what he achieved visually with that film. And the writing goes purely to Paul Wernick and Rhett Reese, no question. And obviously Ryan Reynolds. But if a new trailer came out for Dark Fate and it was good, I think it would turn my excitement around. Only because I'm a huge Terminator fan.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what they decide
to
show.
As long as Sarah Connor doesn't say I'll be back.
She's going to.
No, please.
She's going
Tim
to.
Tim Miller,
it's already been reported.
Tim, if you're listening to this podcast, I love you, man. Do not have her say I'll be back. Please do not. Now, I will allow her to say come with me if you want to live.
Oh, no, don't do any of that.
No. What? I'll be back is tired. Come with me if you want to live, I'm okay with. Because that is, see, come with me if you want to live is actually would be a smart callback because it's only said once in Terminator 2 as he comes out of the elevator, she's on the floor, and he says, come with me if you want to live. That, I am perfectly fine with that being a turned around line. I'll be back is tired, man. I'm sorry. I don't want anyone else saying that anymore. Sorry.
I can't argue with that. And I would like to hear her say, come with me if you like
to. That would be cool, right? Like, I would not mind that moment. I would be perfectly fine with that. Now, if she says, hasta la vista, baby, I'm out of the theater. I'm running out. There's no way I'm having Sarah Connor say, hasta la vista, baby.
What if they pit stop? What if they pit stop at a hotel to rest while they're being chased? And as she dives off the diving board, you watch her go underwater and she's holding her thumb up as it goes under. Is that allowed?
All of these like really bad jokes are better than everything in the trailer for this movie.
Or what if like they bring back the smile scene and someone's teaching her how to smile like from Terminator 2 and she does like the awkward teeth and everything. Oh, man.
You love that scene, don't you? All right, but the big panel that everybody is anticipating from a movie perspective is Saturday night when Marvel Studios returns to Hall H after a year absence. They did not go last year. They claimed they didn't have a lot to promote. They weren't going to tell anybody about Endgame, obviously. Captain Marvel had been out already. Oh, wait, no. I forget what the setup was. Anyway, they didn't want to present last year. And now they're coming back, and they have a 90-minute panel on Saturday, and we were having a conversation with a colleague who mentioned that it's possible, according to him, that this is going to be a victory lap of sorts after Endgame, and you'll see the likes of Downey Jr., Chris Evans, Hemsworth, Scarlett, you know, the original Avengers. I don't agree with that, because I kind of feel like they're done, and if they don't have to go back to San Diego, they're not going to go back to San Diego, so why would they? And I think this is more of a look forward. Which one do you guys think we are going to see on Saturday?
I do find it interesting that the timing of Comic-Con is when Endgame is $7.9 million away from beating Avatar. It's literally that close, to a point where I just kind of want to just pass it until it can get it over with. I mean, it's so close. I wonder if them being brought out at Comic-Con brings more attention back to the film again. Does it help them?
How much more attention could this movie get? I mean, it's been released twice already.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, what?
I've done 84 interviews with the Russos. I mean, what more does this movie need?
I don't know. That's the thing. It's like, I wonder what the thought process would be. What would be the thought process? Like, I mean, Sean mentions the victory lap element of it. I could see that. I could see them getting in front of a crowd for one more time, taking questions from an audience in a full spoiler territory, right? Because everyone's seen the film at this point. So, I don't know.
I feel like it's going to be focused more on the future. And I feel like bringing back the original people is kind of hanging around the past. And I feel like now with Spider-Man kind of like ending phase three, I feel like Feige really wants to go, okay, you know what? That was fun, but we've got a lot more in store. Here we go.
And it's time. He's been saying along this whole journey, you know, we're not going to talk about phase four until Endgame and Far From Home are officially out, right? Like that's been his party line. So now they're officially out. Week two of Far From Home is coming on. The movie's doing really well at the box office. Critically well-received.
Will it get to a billion?
I don't know. That's a good question. Let me look and see.
It's at 850 right now.
It's at 850 worldwide?
Absolutely get to a billion.
Far From Home's at 850 right now.
Absolutely. It absolutely will. No question.
You think it'll make another 150?
Yeah. And it's only been out for like 10 days.
Yes, I think so. Dude, there's a repeat value to Far From Home that a lot of people are going back and looking for other clues. Like, they're really smart where they just did that Mysterio thing.
Like 12 days it's been.
Where they showed Jake Gyllenhaal in that new outfit and said that he's in the background of Venice.
I love Far From Home. I'm just wondering, can it make another $150 million? That's a lot of money.
Absolutely.
Okay, all right, I'm just wondering. I'm just curious what you guys think.
I mean, I know competition's going to pick up with Lion King and Tarantino and Hobbs and Shaw, but... I think quietly, Far From Home could stay in theaters.
Far From Home's at $847 right now. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Good for. I'm so glad for that movie. That's
me
great,
too.
Because I loved
it's
it.
It's a great
Spider-Man
movie.
Spider-Man makes $150 before Avengers makes $8.
Wow.
No way. No, Avengers will make $8 in the next 2 weeks.
The reason Avengers could make $8 in the next is that Disney's going to pair it in like double features with The Lion King.
What do you mean? How do you they
like
can,
in like drive-in theaters around America? They'll pair it up.
Oh, so then who gets the credit? Lion King or Avengers Endgame?
I'm assuming they split.
Split it. Probably it's interesting.
Why wouldn't Disney just funnel $8 million?
I was wondering that too. Why doesn't someone
say,
just
go buy tickets? Yes, go.
Bob Iger just needs to walk up to a theater and rent out of the theater for a week, and then you'll be fine. You'll be good to go, man. Come on.
Then you own
Look,
the record.
Disney's not going to spend money on original ideas. They're not going to spend money on their own movies.
Well, all right. So let's say that.
You hear that? That's the sound of shots fired.
Yes. Right before we bring Kevin Feige on board.
I trash Lion King.
If we speculate on what's coming in phase four, I want to just briefly run through the titles that we know are in some form of pre-production or have been. The hell was that? Something just fell off my desk. Sorry about that.
That's the names that we often drop during an episode, but we haven't been doing them.
Titles that have been revealed by Marvel. So Black Widow. I think Black Widow is the May 2020 release. They've already started filming it. Jake's not enthused by the Black Widow movie.
Oh, I'm sorry. Like, does anyone really care about that character?
Well, especially after she died. Like, now she's dead, and they're going to bring her back for a prequel. So
what are the stakes?
Like, what more needs to be said about that character?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out. But then after that, everything's a mystery. There's a November 2020 release date. And my theory right now is that it was going to be a new property. There's two that are being bandied around in terms of casting. One is called The Eternals, which is a sort of space-based celestial sci-fi property. And the other one being Shang-Chi, the martial arts Marvel Cinematic Universe one. You're hearing a lot about casting for both of those movies. But I almost think that because Disney is stepping back and looking at its slate for 2020 and realizing they don't have a big-time Marvel Avengers movie, they don't have a Star Wars movie, they don't have an Avatar movie ready to go yet because James Cameron won't stop tinkering in his damn lab wherever he's holed up, that they are maybe trying to move Guardians 3 or Black Panther 2 or something else into that November slate.
They can't move Guardians because he's got to shoot
Suicide Squad
first.
Suicide Squad. Disney wants a bigger movie.
James Cameron, if you're listening to our podcast, do me a favor and please...
After we just trash Terminator.
No. Just stop making the Avatar films.
Could you stop making Avatar stop doing Terminator while you're at it?
No, stop making Avatar films and please get the 4K restorations out for Abyss and True Lies as soon as you possibly can, because that's all we really want from you, man. I'm sorry, I don't want another Avatar.
Also, come on the
movie.
Podcast.
James Cameron is the reason why I do what I do today. Terminator 2 changed my life. He has made classics, T1, T2, Avatar, Abyss, Titanic, True Lies. I mean, Avatar was fine, but dude, I want more of your aliens. Come on, give me more of your sci-fi. That type of movie is what I want from him.
But the good news is he has a to-do list of five things, and number five on that is the 4K restorations of those movies that you love. But 1 through 4 is Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yikes.
And they're only going to take 10 years each.
I'm not trying to be a negative person, but I really, really need True Lies on Blu-ray as fast as possible. I cannot believe
that. Also, isn't today the 25th anniversary of True Lies?
Yes, it reminded me how angry I am that movie's not on Blu-ray. I want to watch Arnold say you're fired and blow that guy away on the missile in 4K. I want to see that. I want to see him and Bill Paxton driving down the street together and him punch Bill Paxton in the face and then wake back up. I want to see all that go down again. It's amazing.
I hear you. All right. Well, listen, we will be in San Diego, or I will be in San Diego Comic-Con reporting back from everything that's happening.
Do you
there.
Have any big interviews lined up?
Who are we getting?
The question is, who did Gabe approve? That's the question.
Getting the director of It Chapter 2, Andy Muschietti. We're getting Asher Angel, who's coming by to talk about Shazam. Ooh. We're getting Marcus McFeely, who wrote Infinity War and Endgame, going to the panel for the Russo brothers. We are going to be on a red carpet for Terminator for their presentation, right after their presentation. Then we'll be at the Marvel panel, and then Marvel is doing a press line afterwards, also with whatever talent they bring through.
So
that will be intriguing. And the only man currently who knows everything that's going to be presented at the Hall H panel on Saturday is Marvel President Kevin Feige, who was nice enough to sit down for an interview during the Spider-Man Far From Home junket in London, which we have been teasing you guys for weeks upon weeks. But Gabe finally signed off on it, and we are able to now present the real blend conversation with Marvel President Kevin Feige. So enjoy it.
I have to say,
nice shirt.
Thank you very much.
That's cool.
I bought this shirt here in Forbidden Planet.
Oh, really?
Because I was on my way over to the terminal in Charlotte, North Carolina, and someone else took my suitcase off the bus.
No. You're kidding.
No. I had four of my favorite Spider-Man t-shirts ready to go, and the whole bag was taken, and I didn't notice till we got to the terminal, and by then I just got on a plane to London and came with what
at least
I
you had
wearing.
Your stuff with you. Your equipment with you.
I had a backpack that they didn't take. I guess it was just two black bags that they mistakenly grabbed.
So you made a beeline to Forbidden Planet.
Right, to grab
nice.
This. So
nice.
I have it for today. He's my favorite character of all time.
Oh, great.
And Tom is my favorite interpretation of the character. So, and I need to say thank you for all of this, because as a Marvel kid growing up. You know, to me, it's truly impossible what you guys have achieved.
Thank you.
And people would ask all the time what your favorite MCU, or favorite movie of all time was. They ask film critics that all the time. And McTiernan's Die Hard was my answer.
That's a good answer.
Constantly, yeah. Right? And Endgame replaced it.
Wow.
Like, it floored me. So thank you. Thank you for all your attention to detail. The MCU can go in so many directions from here, obviously. Cosmic, magic, the unknown of Wakanda. What do you guys hope that the Spider-Man movies continue to represent as the MCU continues to grow and evolve?
Well, you know, so much of Far From Home is about taking him far from home, not just to Europe, but, you know, tapping into, as Nick Fury says, you've been to space. He's been to places Peter Parker in the movies had never been to before over his 5 appearances now in the MCU. And yet, in the spoiler territory of the end of the movie, we return him back to New York. And we return to the fun of how awesome it is to see Spider-Man swinging around New York. We return to a new classic version of Jameson that we haven't seen in many films, and yet in a totally different new context. And at the same time, charting new ground for him with his identity is out there, which has never been done before.
No, it hasn't.
In the movies.
And it mirrors Tony's reveal, obviously.
Yes, but one was his choice, one was against his will.
Yeah,
right? That's the difference. That was the difference. So in terms of your question about going forward, it'll be fun to see Spidey back in his element, out of the shadow of Tony, out of the shadow of the other Avengers, as his own man now, as his own hero, and yet now facing his own challenges that aren't coming from Avengers fighting like Civil War or aliens coming like Infinity War and Endgame.
Sure.
It's all Peter-focused and Peter-based.
Right. And villains that have a grudge with Tony.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Which is now that grudge clearly has been passed to Peter by the end of the movie.
Yeah, very much so. The plan at the time when we went to the Homecoming set and all throughout it was to give him one per year for his high school. Still the plan, or will he get like a senior year movie? Or
I mean, you know, we'll see what exactly happens, but we like that model. We like the notion of doing that. His junior year, which we see in this movie, we see the tail end of and focus on that summer adventure, which was an early idea as we were thinking about it. So I don't really know, but makes sense.
The blip affords you, you know, the ability to
exactly
to play with how ages are necessarily people on screen. That was very funny. So you were with us on the set.
Yes, yep, absolutely.
You revealed a lot without revealing anything.
Yeah. that's
the
job.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because you mentioned Brad, and you were like, he's going to have a love interest, and it's Brad, and he's with MJ a lot. And then when they reveal what Brad is, I was like, that's really funny. That's really good. I knew Brad was in it, but not quite the way. You name drop the multiverse, and it's misdirection to a certain extent, but now it's there. You know, now it's an idea. And it has this terms of like Earth 616, and things are going to be really important to people. You know, how far off are we before the multiverse is something people have to grapple with?
Well, the Ancient One mentions the multiverse in Doctor Strange.
Oh, okay.
When she's taking him on that mind trip where she touches his head and she goes, she discusses the multiverse and the various planes. In dimensions and realms there. So we've mentioned it before. We've established it before and certainly have plans to explore it more.
Okay.
Mysterio just happens to be full of it in his version.
He's really leaning into it. Mysterio, I'm glad you brought him up because he's a villain that almost feels like you couldn't have done him properly until effects caught up to what he can do convincingly now.
Mm-hmm.
That it might have been kitschy, you know, if you tried to do his effects that way. Did any of that lend to why you chose him for now? Because with the drones and the way that he's able to do his illusions, it's far more credible. It was far more believable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really was the fact that we hadn't seen him in a movie before and we thought that he could provide a unique challenge to Peter coming off of the events of Endgame. I guess we take it for granted now, almost for the entirety of Marvel Studios, certainly, that the amazing visual effects teams can do anything, can pull off anything. Thanos threw a moon at Iron Man, right? We can do almost anything now. So it comes down to how you do it and how you make it believable. And Yannick Sears, our amazing VFX supervisor on this movie, has such an eye for detail and such an eye for making things seem authentic, and is very rigorous with us, even in the script stages, about helping us make it seem as real as possible, even though what Mysterio does, shoots beams from his hands, has the cool smoke that he's got in the comics, seemingly is very supernatural. As you've seen in the movie, the twist of how he pulls it off.
And what he says, too, really struck a chord of people aren't listening to what you have to say, you know, unless you have a cape, unless you have...
You're the first person to mention that, and I'm very glad you did, because that was very important to us.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Can you explain more? Can you elaborate?
Well, because it seemed like a fun commentary on the world, not just in terms of the dominance of superhero films, but in terms of the way the media works. Mm. So when he's saying a cape and lasers, yes, he's talking about the MCU and superheroes, but it's also, if you're the loudest, the flashiest, the craziest haircut, the craziest outfit, you get the most media attention.
Right.
Not if you have the best ideas or if you have the best thoughts for how something should be done.
And then I make a connection to what John said earlier about it's the media that eventually outs Peter, you know?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
I think that's a really interesting twist.
Earlier in the movie, he talks about Night Monkey to MJ. Yeah. And she says it was on the news. He goes, well, Night Monkey said it was Night Monkey. The news doesn't lie.
Yeah.
That got a good laugh in the theater. Yes, for sure. Jake is, you know, a new face. Obviously, you're bringing back the Homecoming cast, and Sam comes on over from multiple projects. But was he somebody you had targeted before?
Yes.
Somebody you wanted to bring in?
No, we wanted to work with him for years and years, and it often takes time to find the right scheduling, to find the right timing, most importantly, to find the right project.
Okay.
And this was the right project, and it seemed. He's such an amazing actor who can be charismatic and charming, but he can also be scary.
Mm.
So we talked about having the very dashing, romanticized Jake Gyllenhaal, and then having the Nightcrawler, not the X-Men character, the movie that he did, Nightcrawler,
sure. Kind
of slightly off, scary version. And what was so fun, we talked to Jake, he was like, you get to do both.
Yeah.
In this movie, you do both.
Yeah.
And he crushed it.
And he looks like a darker version of Tony Stark when he puts the glasses on.
So good. Yeah, exactly. that between his performance, his entire look, and that amazing costume, which Ryan Meinerding in our visual development department designed and our amazing costume team built, that it just looks heroic. So even if you're a big Spider-Man fan and know the story of Mysterio, there's a point in the movie where you're like, well, I guess they do things differently. I guess they're telling a different version of the story because he looks really cool and I like their bonding. And then, of course,
the moment when the madness of Mysterio sequence, essentially where he's fully immersed in Peter, and it's Steve Ditko brought to life, right?
Yes, exactly.
It is so well done, you know, and I just love, and that's what I was saying, like, you can't effectively do Mysterio until you have the ability to do that, right? And because every time it took it out of it and you saw where Peter really was, you know, he punches behind him and he ends up punching a pillar. And
exactly.
Like, I'm as immersed in this effect
as
Peter is in that moment. So that blew me away. You obviously adore the Golden Age Spidey villains.
Mm-hmm.
We've had Vulture now. Hey, you're raising the bar in terms of actors who can play villains in this franchise. I don't know where you'd get Pacino to come on over or something like that. But, you know, selfishly, I'm wondering, when are we going to get to a time where we can do Doc Ock and we can do Norman again? Are they still so far off the table because they've been used before, or?
I mean, not necessarily. It just depends on, is it the right story? Is it the right time? Okay. Is there the right angle to do it again in a way that feels fresh and doesn't feel like, oh, here it is again.
Okay.
Because Spidey, as you know better than anyone, has a great roster of villains.
Sure.
Great number of them, and Mysterio and Vulture being two of the best that hadn't been brought to the screen before.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it all depends on what the story is.
Okay.
It all depends on what the angle is.
If it's the most exciting idea to us, that's the one we're going to chase down, whether it's a new character or one we've seen before.
Yeah.
What about the concept of Venom? He's existing in his own side now. Fans really want to see them combine.
Mm-hmm.
Is that realistic at all?
I think probably is. It's up to Sony. Okay. Sony, you know, has both those characters and has Venom in their world. I don't know what their plans are for another Venom or for doing that.
Okay.
But seems likely at some point.
Do you think the concept of an Avengers film is going to go on the shelf for a little while in favor of team-up movies and solo sequels?
I guess I'd put that in the category of future stuff that we're waiting until Endgame now is out and waiting until this movie comes out before we start talking about what comes next.
Okay, got it.
But there are a lot of other stories and characters that we want to explore.
Can we expect a triumphant Hall H panel return?
I don't know that we've officially announced either way. We usually only go to Hall H when we have a lot of stuff to talk about or reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like we have a lot of stuff to talk about and reveal.
Okay.
But we'll see what we officially announce one way or the other. There's also D23 later this summer.
Yeah.
And we've always gone to D23.
Okay, sounds good. I put out to reader questions. Almost everybody came back with X-Men questions.
Mm-hmm.
I know obviously there are no details and there's a lot of stuff in play, but have you at least started thinking about how the mutants and mutant genes can be introduced into the MCU?
Yes. And the other secret is we never stop thinking about it, right? We're always thinking about things. We're always sitting in rooms coming up with cool stories about anything. So we had been thinking about it for years. The fact that they're back now, the fact that they're in our, you know, back home where they belong, and that now Marvel has what DC has, what Harry Potter has, what Star Wars has, which is access to all of their characters.
Right, right.
You sort of take for granted that it's unusual for a company not to have access to all their characters.
Right.
And the fact now that we have almost all of them back is pretty nice.
That's awesome.
It's pretty amazing.
Great. I will let you guys get out of here on that one.
Thank you
so much, man. I really appreciate the time.
All right. I want to point out how important that moment was for me personally. We've been talking a lot about getting Tarantino on the podcast. And believe me, it melts my brain that Quentin was a guest on the show. And then next week we will be able to present actual audio. You can go on Cinema Blend now. We ran a Star Trek answer that Quentin gave us. It's a tease for next week's show. And I'm telling you guys, when we heard the clip of Quentin answering a question that we lobbed at him, it's just my stomach dropped and I got goosebumps. And it's like, that's Quentin answering a question that we gave him. However,
I can't believe it's real.
I'm also going to say that for me personally, Feige marginally trumps Quentin. And this is how I know this is the case. I've got my picture with Feige pinned to the top of my Twitter page, and I was going to replace it with the Quentin photo, right? Because I was like, this is who's going to get this picture? Like, it's incredible, right? And I saw Feige looking back at me, and I thought, I can't. It's the MCU. It's Marvel. It's everything that I grew up in. It's my childhood realized on the big screen, and this man is the architect of it. And these guys will tell you they were with me in London.
It was cool to see you after that.
I don't get nervous, but that one I just needed. Not that I was nervous to do it, but I needed it to go well. You know, like you're never really nervous going into these rooms, but sometimes you overthink it of just like, oh, could this go wrong? Like, what if the questions don't work? What if it doesn't happen? You know, what if we don't connect?
And also, right? Isn't there sometimes, and I know that, you know, we've all experienced it, without going full fanboy or like geeking out to an obnoxious degree, you want someone like that, whether it's Kevin Feige for you or Tarantino for Kevin or Tom Hanks for myself, you want them to know how much of an impact they've had on your life. And you want them to recognize that.
Yes.
And appreciate that.
Yes.
And that's a cool moment. If you can make that happen without crossing that very thin line into stalker fanboy territory.
Well, and I'll tell everybody listening here, the one thing I kept saying to Jake when he kept asking me like how it went, and I was trying to recollect how it went and how I thought it went, was that those couple of questions that I asked at the start of the interview, I think signified my fandom to him. So that there were times, and if you go back and listen through the interview, there are times when he said things like, well, you know, real fans of Spider-Man or the comic book fans. And then he'd say, like, I don't have to tell you that, but they know this. And I was like, oh, like that, just hearing
game over,
that
man.
Was game over. Like chills over my body of like Feige recognizes,
see,
recognizes how much I do.
I understand that excitement because, and I'm just joking around with you about saying you can't put Feige ahead of Tarantino, but because I understand, like, because Feige has realized your childhood, Tarantino is literally who I grew up watching from like age 12 or 13 to now. My whole house is Tarantino'd. You guys all saw that memorabilia I had on the table for him. I mean, that, so to match what Sean's talking about, I totally get that. Like after the Tarantino interview, I called Lauren. I was like, it's practically in tears. Like I couldn't even speak. Yeah. I was in shock. So I understand the feeling of what that felt like to have that room and to walk out of that room. So I get that.
It was very cool. Yeah. Cool. All right. So I hope you guys enjoyed the Feige interview. Go see Spider-Man Far From Home. And then of course, come on back to Cinema Blend on Saturday night and Sunday as we plan to have plenty of wrap up coverage from what we hope is a lot of news coming out of the Marvel panel. So, okay.
This Are you guys going to be continuously posting stuff while you're there?
We'll tweet stuff. Yeah. And especially, for every movie panel, we'll either have reaction videos to footage that we saw.
Ooh, yeah.
We'll break down things, specific things I saw. But if Marvel lays out their full Phase 4 slate like they did this before Phase 3, Marvel basically just decided one day they were going to do a press day at the El Capitan, which coincidentally is where we saw Lion King, which we're about to talk about next. And I swear to you, on a Monday, Disney called me and said, can one of you guys be at El Capitan tomorrow at 2 p.m.? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I think so. Sure, why? What's going on? They're like, you want to be there. They didn't even want to tell us what it is, but they were just like, trust me, you want to be there. So we sent Eric Eisenberg went. And it was Feige. He just came out onto the stage and mapped out Phase 3. Like, he was just like, wow. Hey, we've got a lot of exciting things planned. We decided now is the time to share it. And it was really fascinating to see them do it, because they were essentially throwing down the gauntlet and saying, we don't need Comic-Con. We don't need D23. When we decide to tell you what our slate is going to be, you're all going to pay attention to it.
But yeah. Now could you argue that they do need Comic-Con because Phase 4 is not going to be as exciting as Phase 3 was? Like, they're kind of taking a step back and they have to introduce a lot of characters and they have to make us care about all of this again. So now, ironically, they do need Comic-Con.
They probably do. They'll benefit from the boost, that's for sure. But once we know what the titles are, I think we'll have a better sense of what's coming and how excited everybody can get for it. Speaking about what's coming and how excited we all can get for it, we saw The Lion King. And here's where The Lion King suffers slightly for some of us. We saw it the night after we saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And you shouldn't be the movie that follows the new Quentin Tarantino film, especially when the new Quentin Tarantino film works as well as it does. And we can't go much further on that beyond reactions and reviews until a little bit later on. But I want Kevin to go first because he liked The Lion King, the new version by director Jon Favreau, more than Jake and I did. And so I want him to have the opportunity to explain to us why he liked it so much and why it connected with him.
Did you guys hear about Jon Favreau's favorite Lucy Boynton film?
I only know her from Bohemian Rhapsody. So
The Lion King Street? Sing Street, get it? Because there was no, yeah.
She is in that too. That's right. That's pretty good.
Anyways.
That's
pretty good. They're in all the model, good. Right? Anyway, so I thought this movie was incredible. Jake and I and Sean saw it together. I went in with very low. Oh, Gabe, you don't talk.
Gabe was there.
I can't even laugh.
Gabe was there. That's my favorite moment ever.
I did sit next to Gabe, and I laughed a lot about farting.
Oh, you were sitting next to him, and you forgot.
No, I didn't forget. But Gabe doesn't talk on the show, so I can't include him in the conversation. There were a lot of funny moments where, like, there's some farting humor in the movie. I just looked over at Jake and Sean and just started cracking up.
Oh my gosh, Kevin was so happy. He was so happy at the farting humor.
And then I had a very professional conversation with Seth Rogen about farting at the junket, which was very happy. It made me very happy. I went into this film with I guess middle of the road expectations. I didn't love Aladdin, the live action remake. I thought it was okay. But I loved Jon Favreau's Jungle Book live action remake, which I thought was phenomenally well done. So going into this, I went in with a lot of reservations. One, why is this being remade? Two, the original is so great. Why do I need this version? And three, I was just a little concerned about all these live action remakes, Little Mermaid, Mulan. I mean, there's so many. I'm interested in them because of the updated technology. But the moment Lion King started, there's an adjustment period that it takes a second to kind of adjust to the effects because they're so realistic, so photoreal that it's almost like a strange. It's like if you took your glasses off and you can't really see, and then you put your glasses on and your vision comes into sight. That's kind of how the beginning couple minutes were for me, just because it is so gorgeous to look at. I think the Lion King, Favreau's Lion King it's an incredible cinematic achievement from a visual standpoint. I think that the voice performances, there are some I absolutely loved, and some of them I thought could have been done by somebody else. But I want to point out specifically Timon and Pumbaa, Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner, who just crush it. They're amazing in the movie. A lot of their material is brand new, and it's very funny. And
they're
very well
so
done.
Funny from the minute they come on. I really thought they were really funny.
Billy Eichner's performance is brilliant. I mean, it's phenomenal. That being said, I also thought Donald Glover was great. I thought that Shahadi Wright Joseph was great as young Nala. I thought that Alfre Woodard was great as Mufasa's, what would you even say? Mufasa's wife? Yeah. And then Chiwetel Ejiofor is the one I really want to point out. Jeremy Irons is almost an impossible voice to follow. It's iconic. Scar is iconic. And I was immediately taken in by Chiwetel's performance. I thought his voice performance didn't sound anything like Chiwetel Ejiofor. I think if it had been someone that had a very more familiar voice that I'd recognize, I would have been taken out of it. But Chiwetel found a way around, like, because Chiwetel is British. He sounds very specific when you talk to him, right? And it didn't sound anything like him. I thought it was amazing what he did with Scar. And visually, it's just mind-blowing, the effects and the water effects. And I was, like, focusing a lot on the little things, like the splashes. What blew my mind visually was the breathing. And I spent a lot of time looking at the breathing of the animals. There were moments where I would just watch their chests go up and down. The detail of the footprints, the stepping in the water, the running, the songs. It was an incredible cinematic experience that for a second took me a while to get into it. And then once it did, it fully grabbed me. And I was in again. I was all in again on the story. So much so that this is not a spoiler. We all know what happens to Mufasa in the original film. Favreau immersed me so much that I was kind of hopeful that might change. And I thought that was really well done on their part, kind of how they animated or digitally did that experience. Everything in this film is fully CGI, except for one live action shot, which Jon Favreau says he won't tell what it is. And all of James Earl Jones's lines are brand new, except for one yell, which they pulled from the original dialogue. So I was super impressed at the overall experience of this. Also, Favreau had them all together a lot of the time, like a theater rehearsal, getting these scenes down. And to me, that's what made it work. On the negative side, I think Beyoncé's voice performance, besides her singing performance, wasn't great.
Kevin, the Beyoncé army's coming for you, man.
That's
you
fine.
Better watch out.
Listen, I think Beyoncé's singing is incredible. Her dialogue delivery, I did not buy into, personally. I thought that Donald Glover was amazing. I mean, overall, I loved the film. I loved it. I thought it was incredibly well done, and I have only very minimal things I didn't love about it. If you're gonna say to me, Kevin, what's the better version? I mean, I'm gonna go with the original animated version from the '90s because it's just so special to me. But I'm very happy that this movie exists. And I'm very happy to see these photorealized, photorealistic CGI characters that just brought a different side into me, a deeper side of humanity to the characters, in my opinion.
I'm going to agree with everything that Kevin said for the most part, because he's right. Like, it looks amazing. Visually, it improves, you know, and shows off what they can do from this perspective. And a lot of the vocal performances, like Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner, I think are really, really funny. They bring a different shade to Timon and Pumbaa.
Yeah.
That I really appreciated. I recognized two things while I was sort of watching this. I didn't realize how much I knew more about the Broadway show than I did the original
animated version. And I've never seen the Broadway show, so.
There were songs from the Broadway show that are waiting to show up in the movie, and they don't. And then I kind of turned to Jake at the end, and I was like, where was that song? And he was like, that's not in the original movie. And
right.
I just, they all kind of blended together for me.
Lion King does not have that many songs in
right,
it.
Right, right.
But the iconic ones are Hakuna Matata, Can You Feel the Love Tonight, The Lion Sleeps Tonight. I mean,
I'd argue all of them are iconic.
They are. I mean, they're.
Lion Sleeps Tonight in the movie? That's in the original movie?
Very briefly, as long as it is in this remake.
It's great in the remake, though. And I
like that version.
I like that version. By the way, at the beginning of this Lion King, who was singing Circle of Life? It wasn't Elton John.
No.
Well, it's not Elton John in the other one either.
Elton John wrote Circle of Life, correct?
I know he wrote. He wrote Can You Feel the Love Tonight?
He didn't write Circle of Life?
I don't know that he didn't, but I'm not entirely sure he did.
Okay,
I'm not sure. My knock on Lion King and my knock on most of these live-action remakes, and Jake, I think you might be in this ballpark too. I just don't enjoy sitting in a movie theater and knowing what scene is going to come next all the way through. And it's a fault of the idea of a live-action remake of any remake, that I'm always going to hold it against the movie.
But The Thing is a remake. John Carpenter's The Thing is a remake, and we all praise and love that film.
But I don't know the original.
And I don't know the original remake, quite as well.
It's like I think people are holding this remake to a higher standard because it's so much of a big part of our lives growing up. That I think they go, oh, you can't remake The Lion King. You cannot touch that
movie.
Well,
to refute your argument, if that's the case, then it shouldn't be remade. The reason The Thing could be remade by John Carpenter is because not that many people grew up with the original or have that much of a heartfelt connection to the original. That's the kind of movie you remake, not the freaking Lion King.
See,
I
disagree with that.
Well, I'll just say this. I'll say this, like, Aladdin is an example. The change of Will Smith as a genie was drastic enough that every time he showed up, the genie scenes felt fresh and new because I was waiting to see what he did with it. So that kept me more engaged. Whereas I thought the Lion King remake was faithful to the original to a fault. You know, like I knew exactly what was going to play out as it played out, and it played out well. That's why my tweet right after it finished was, yep, that was a Lion King.
We all love Ocean's 11. That's a remake. We all love The Departed.
Yes, but we have no connection.
We all love Scarface.
We have no connection.
That's a remake.
But we have no connection. You're naming films.
No,
not to the original.
We have no connection because you weren't alive when the original came out. The point I'm making is we were all alive when the first Lion King came out, so we feel personally affected by
a remake. I wasn't alive when Jaws came out, but I would be pissed if they remade Jaws.
That's
what I'm saying, but if they remade Jaws.
Soderbergh Ocean's 11 is nothing like the Frank Sinatra one.
It's still a remake.
But it's totally different.
It's still a remake. So is Scarface. These are all remakes.
And that and the Oliver Stone, who directed Scarface?
Brian De Palma.
Brian De Palma. The De Palma version's nothing like the original.
Let Me In, a great remake of a Swedish film. And it was pretty much the same movie.
The original's better.
Original is better, but
Let Me In doesn't need to exist.
Let Me In was amazing. I love Let Me In.
Anyway, Jake, how do you feel about Lion King?
I hated Lion King. And with every day that passes, I hate it more and more. I hated it.
That's such a drastic term.
The photorealistic visuals. I thought at first, I was like, oh, that's pretty spectacular. But the more and more that time passed with the movie, it just felt cold and emotionless. I mean, because they're working so hard to make it look realistic, the animals don't really get to emote. I mean, in the original film, they're very expressive. And in the musical numbers, they're dancing around and they're bebopping. And this one, they're kind of just walking while they sing. And they barely register any hint of emotion. And it kind of starts to look like a National Geographic special that's narrated by celebrities. It's like the first movie was beautiful and bright. It had all these colorfuls of animation. And this one is like, here's 84 different shades of tan. And I love, I mean, realism can be pretty fantastic, but it doesn't make animation better. They have exchanged realism for personality. They've exchanged realism for soul. And there's just nothing empty. The Lion King in 94 was Shakespeare, and this is Cliff Notes. It's the same story, but the heart is not there. I did not think that the vocal performances were good. To me, because the animals had no emotions on their faces, it was like, look, that lion sounds like Beyonce. That lion sounds like Donald Glover. Even James Earl Jones sounded like he was bored of saying these lines for the 100th time. And look, I'm not trying to be this guy who grew up with the original and I'm shaking my fist at the sky, you know, like annoyed that they did something to my childhood. You know, if there had been, you know, to me, Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen are a perfect example of a reason something needs to existed because they did something different with the characters. They got new lines. It felt fresh. It felt different. If the entire movie had felt like that, then I would be a little bit kinder to it. But they're the only part that I felt was different. And look, I mean, keep in mind, these stories have been told before. Aladdin is 1,000 years old. Mulan is a true story. Lion King is Hamlet. They've been told before. They're going to be told again. So I'm not mad that it's being told again because it's going to happen over and over again. But at the end of the day, if everyone universally agrees, which I feel like they're going to, that they would just rather watch the 94 version over this one, then why does this movie need to exist?
See, let me ask,
I can't find any other reason other than money.
Jake,
it exists to make money.
Oh my God. Okay, so all right, so that means that every remake that was ever done because of money should not be seen. So it's True Grit.
No, because
True Grit,
other
Jake, what'd you think
of
True Grit?
No, but there are other they tried to do something different. They didn't do anything
Jake,
different with this
what
movie.
What did you
Kevin?
Think of True Grit?
I loved the new
I loved
True
it,
Grit.
And it's different.
Why? Why did we need it? See, the thing is, like,
because it's different. Because they gave us something different,
no, that's,
Kevin.
That's
you're,
a
ignoring
dangerous
my,
path
you're ignoring
to go
my
down.
Whole there argument.
30
and focusing
minutes of
on
different
one
footage
thing.
In Lion King. It's
and
30
it's
minutes.
Shit.
Oh, it's no. That. See, to me,
dude. Also, what is what? Just because it's 30 minutes longer doesn't mean there's 30 minutes of new footage.
No, I didn't say that. I've said
there's,
that.
There's something completely different.
Your argument
why
is why
isn't 30 minutes longer,
why?
Too?
Exactly. What because, the, I mean, no. what in that movie
what did they
justified
add?
The 30? Exactly. Exactly.
Jay's argument is why do we need a remake? You could say that
yeah,
about
but you're looking,
every
okay,
single movie
my
ever
argument
made.
Is why do we need a remake if it's going to be basically the exact same movie but soulless? And then you're naming all of these other remakes that are inherently different than their source material.
What about Peter Jackson's
said,
King Kong? Great, I love Peter Jackson's King Kong.
I'd argue that movie doesn't need to exist either.
Am I not allowed to like that movie
like
because
you,
it shouldn't
you,
exist? Come on,
I didn't say you, dude. I'm not
sense.
Saying not allowed to like anything either. But like, if a director comes up and says, "Look, I was inspired by that movie. I want to try to do something different with it," then I would at least, whether or not I like it or not, at least respect it. Jon Favreau did nothing other than say, "I'm gonna make the lions look real."
What about 310 to Yuma, Jake? What'd you think of 310 to Yuma?
You keep naming movies that are like you're not listening to my
but
argument.
They're
you
remakes.
Keep naming movies, but they are different than the source.
Tell
material.
Me
okay, listen
how
to my words.
Different.
Listen to my words.
The 310 to Yuma movie is different
have
from
you
the
seen
original.
The original 310 to Yuma takes place in one room, Kevin.
Right.
It basically takes place in one room.
That's fine.
The new movie is different, and
okay.
he added more, and he added okay. characters. You're not listening to my argument. You're not listening to what I'm telling you.
I am listening to what you're
there's
saying.
A difference, there's a difference to a director taking a source material and making it his own versus Jon Favreau going, I'm going to make the same movie, and I'm going to charge you for it.
Okay, I disagree with that.
I'm with Jake in this
100%. That's fine. I'm okay, but yeah. I disagree
you
with
you keep like giving examples that prove my points.
I'm not against the concept of a remake, but all the good ones take old premises
hey,
and
Jake,
refresh them.
Jake, what did you think of the movie A Star Is Born? The fourth remake of that movie, the same exact story, and the guy
different.
Dies at the end. Jake, you
it's
cannot.
Still
a
different.
Star Is Born is the
it's
exact
not shot
same
for shot.
Movie.
It's not it's, shot for shot. It's
oh
not the
my
same
God.
Line.
A Star Is Born is the exact same movie, and
it's
I love A Star Is Born, but your
movie,
argument
Kevin.
Is flawed
not,
in my opinion.
It's not. All you're doing is. Doubling down on
no.
my argument.
No, I'm not.
All you're
you
doing
said
is,
a star.
You
said, why did A Star Is Born need to be
it
remade?
It is different.
tell me why.
There's definitely no scene in the previous Star Is Borns where she sings La Vie en Rose in a drag bar. And okay. There is not a scene where she becomes a pop star on Saturday Night Live.
Is there a scene in the original Lion King where Hakuna Matata, or not Hakuna Matata, but the actual dialogue between Puma and Timon happened the way it exactly did in the 1994 version?
If you have to dig deep enough to go to the exact wording between two characters, your argument is shallow. No,
give me a star rating. Give me a star rating for the new Lion King.
You're saying that a movie does not...
No, because all you're doing is naming remakes that prove my point.
No, I'm not.
There are a lot of remakes that should exist.
A Star Is Born is the exact same movie made four times in a row. And I love A Star Is Born.
Dude, you realize that like he dies in different ways in all the movies? No, like they meet different ways.
Come on, that's such a ridiculous argument that the movie can't be good if it doesn't necessarily have to be remade. A Star Is Born.
I never said that. Some of my favorite movies of all time are remakes.
Amazing.
I'm not saying that a movie that's a remake doesn't need to exist. It needs to justify its existence. Lots of remakes
Why did Star Is Born need to be remade? Why?
I'm not saying it needed to, but it at least justified its existence.
Well, how did it justify its existence?
By doing something different.
I'll even argue that when it was announced that Clint Eastwood was going to remake Star Is Born with Beyonce, I thought, well, no one needs that movie.
Right.
Because he would have done the exact same thing. But because it was really good, you give it a pass. And then now Lion King.
No, because he does something different.
No,
Jon Favreau does nothing.
It's the same story. It's the same story, man.
No, it's the exact same story. The thing is the same story, but it still does something different. 3:10 to Yuma is the same story, but it does something different.
Star Is Born is literally a remake that's been done four times, and you were perfectly fine with it and put it in your number one of the year. That makes no sense to me. Absolutely different films. No, I disagree.
Do you guys know the Rotten Tomatoes grade for Favreau's Lion King?
I know it's flirting between being fresh and rotten.
I would assume 27%. What's it at?
It's like
61. 61. Oh. My point with the 61 is that I'm a little bit stunned. I thought it was going to be a lot higher. I thought it would be in the 80s or low 90s, actually, to be honest with you. Breaking news while we're having this conversation, our Tarantino Star Trek quote got picked up by the very first outlet, and they're running with it right now. We got this covered. Has our quotes where they call us, let me see. This has fans concerned that this new entry in the spacefaring saga will count as the 10th movie, and oh no, we'll never get another Tarantino project again. Can you even imagine? During an interview with the Real Blend podcast crew, though, he talked about a loophole that could make lots of people happy, and then they block quote our story from our podcast.
Awesome.
So that's awesome. Yeah, making the rounds. All right, let's get into our blend game. Take from this past conversation what you will of The Lion King, whether we are sending you to it or not. I still think that if you have a family, you should probably take them to it. Why not? I mean, it's big screen entertainment. It looks great. Give it a shot. Why not?
Wait. Cinema Blend, while we're on this topic, just posted that Star Trek article. And Kevin, if you thought you got feisty about the Lion King, prepare yourself for this.
Uh-oh.
Let me read a quote. Wouldn't Tarantino, and I'm curious as to who wrote this article exactly. And this is from the Cinema Blend article from our interview, Kevin, which we were also a part of.
Check the byline.
Wouldn't Tarantino want to ensure that his final movie was as groundbreaking, boundary pushing, and wildly original as all of the films that he has developed up until this point? From Django Unchained and Pulp Fiction to the two Kill Bill movies.
I mean, yeah.
When you run a site.
Who wrote that?
But Sean.
Yours truly.
How do we get no, like, editorial vote on that whatsoever?
You don't work for the site. You can say whatever you want on Fox 32 Chicago. I can't correct you.
Oh, I will.
Anne Hathaway blend.
Hey, Jake, what do you think of the 1986 Fly movie with Jeff Goldblum? Is that okay to remake?
Dude, all you're doing is doubling down on my
was
argument.
Was that okay to remake that movie? I mean, I don't know if it's necessary.
Yeah, because the two Fly really movies are... We can do this all day. We're getting the wrap.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like I don't really know if it's necessary to remake the Fly movie, right? It was made in 86. I don't know. Better effects.
The thing. Fact that you were like... your headbuds must not be working because you're not listening to what I'm
telling
you.
The Departed was a remake? I mean, come on, man.
You're not... Oh my God, you're not listening to what
Reservoir
I'm telling
Dogs
you.
Reservoir Dogs is kind of a remake. I mean, there's so many like...
Kevin, come on, you got to argue better than this, man. You got to at least address what I'm telling
you. Reservoir Dogs isn't a remake. It's just it's based on certain things. But yeah, anyways.
Anne Hathaway blend.
Let's see who gets to go first, according to the show notes that I have open and I'm going down. Oh, Gabe didn't. Oh, I get to go first. Gabe is hastily adding names willy nilly.
Gabe to just keep wants the this blend episode game to be over with.
Moving along. I picked Rachel getting married. Which is a devastatingly beautiful film that convinced me Anne Hathaway would be an actress to contend with for years to come. Now, prior to her appearing in that Jonathan Demme film, which if people haven't seen it yet, she is a troubled younger sister who's returning from drug rehab and is coming home to her somewhat hippie family. Everyone's concerned that her addictions and her destructive personality is going to disrupt the wedding. And the wedding is a very bohemian, casual hangout with some really beautiful turns by the parents. And I forget the name of the actress who plays her older sister. I'm going to click and find out. But Hathaway was coming off of a string of movies. Rosemary DeWitt gives a really great performance as Anne Hathaway's older sister. Prior to this, Anne Hathaway was in Get Smart, Becoming Jane. She was in Devil Wears Prada, but I'd argue got overshadowed by Meryl Streep, Stanley Tucci, and...
Emily Blunt?
Yes, thank you. Brokeback Mountain, where, again, you know, supporting part and overshadowed by the two leads. And her Princess Diaries and Ella Enchanted movies. So, you know, no one really knew what to make of her at this point. She was definitely a movie star. She could carry franchise. She was good in all of those films. And then Rachel Getting Married, she devastated me with the way that she held down this really, really difficult character. And I will say that Anne Hathaway's performances sometimes rub me the wrong way. They come across as cool and artificial. And someone once tweeted a long time ago, and this nailed how I feel about Anne Hathaway and really have a hard time saying out loud sometimes. She said, Anne Hathaway always looks like someone who's having a really good time in pictures, but is thinking to herself, I'm having fun now. And it's bogus. Like, you can't buy into it. And I feel that way about so many of her performances. But I didn't at all in Rachel Getting Married. I thought she was as honest and raw and authentic as I've ever seen her. So I'm going to single that out as not only one of her best performances, but also one of the best movies that she's been involved in.
That's a great movie.
That's a good
Thank
movie.
Thank you. It's a really solid film. Yeah. That's and a
I
little bit.
I hope they don't remake it. That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah, I don't want them to remake that movie. You know, that'd be a
Jake,
bad
you get
idea.
To go next. If they do remake it, I hope they make changes to it.
Right.
Yes, because then it would justify its existence, unlike Kevin's argument, which
they
keeps doing the same thing over and over
Lion
again.
King. It's not the same movie, actually, but yes, there you
it's,
go.
Dear God. My pick, it's funny that you talked about movies where she was the starring role, yet somehow often found herself being overshadowed by supporting characters, because I'm going to pick a role in which I feel like she did the exact opposite, where she was a supporting character but somehow overshadowed everyone else, which is her role in Les Mis.
There you go.
I mean, we're talking about a character that disappears really at the end of the first act, but in a nearly, what is it, 2.5 hour long musical?
Yes.
Her show stopping number, the moment for which she won the Oscar, I mean, resonates through the rest of that movie.
I'll tell you too, like with that scene, like there was so much pre-release Oscar buzz for her performance and that song in particular.
Yeah.
That I'll tell you personally, and I think a lot of other people did it, when it arrived at that moment in the film, like I folded my arms and I was
here
like,
here we go.
All right, you know, here's your chance. Go ahead, do it, right?
Impress me.
And then she sang it and I was like, that race is over.
Yep, done. It's game wow. over. Wow. It's an absolute. I mean, like, I went through a couple of different choices. In fact, I even texted Gabe something earlier that was my pick and then ended up changing my mind because I just can't. The fact that she could be in a movie with those showstopper, with those incredible actors, and when the movie's over and we haven't seen her in an hour and a half, and I'm like, she's the first thing I want to talk about, I think is a testament to her as an actress and what she brought to that very limited role, really. Yeah. But it's just absolutely tremendous. And
that had to be a really hard film for her to do the Oscar circuit for because she's barely in it. You know,
I mean, she was. I mean, I remember when we did the junket.
Yeah.
She was the room you prepared for. She was the one that you wanted to get. I mean, like, yeah, we got everybody.
Yeah.
But that was the room that you wanted to make sure that, you know, if your flight was running late, you got that, or you know, you got that room no matter what.
That's funny.
I asked her a question at that junket that I still don't believe she gave me the right answer for. And it still bothers me to this day. No.
What is it?
Because if you watch that scene really closely, Anne Hathaway has that singing performance and that tear rolls down her face at the exact moment of an exact note. If you watch that scene closely, the tear rolls down her eye and she hits it during the right moment at a right note. And I asked her as an actress, do you have to time that tear? Because if it's done in one shot, which it is, the whole scene's done in one shot from what I understand. I have to go back and look at it again. That tear rolls down her face at the exact right time. You cannot tell me that she did not time that, meaning that she did not let go of that tear at a right
time. How do you let go of a tear at a time?
Because if it's bubbling up in your eye, you can blink and it'll fall down. So my point is, I asked her that and she made me feel like an idiot for asking that question. I'm sorry, let me clarify. She didn't make me feel like an idiot. She just basically said, there's no way you can time the tear. I'm like, watch the scene again. It is, there's no way you cannot not time that. Or it's CGI. I don't know, but
I think it might be CGI.
Do you think that's why she didn't answer it? Because the tear is CGI?
Is it possible that she was, not offended is the wrong word, but like she was taken aback by that question because she didn't want to, like, it would take away from the thought that, like, she's that good of an actress and she pulled it off.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. I'll say this. Anne Hathaway's always been super nice, super respectful. I said the word making me feel like an idiot only because I felt like an idiot after asking the question because I thought it was stupid. But then I looked back at the scene and I still want to know the answer to that. I want to know how they timed that tear falling.
I'm going to very briefly just interject here. Because you guys have had wonderful experiences with Anne Hathaway, and she's my story of I had the worst junket experience of my
what?
Life.
What? You've never told me. She's always been so nice to me. Always. She's such a nice person.
Dude, she and I have our bit.
Your junket wife bit, which is infamous at this point now, and worked extremely well to your favor over the course of multiple junkets. And you guys rode it for as long as you needed to, and it worked out great. But whenever, and believe
you've
me, people ask us
this.
You've
never told us this story.
People ask us this all the time. What's your best interview you've ever had and what's your worst? And I have two worsts. One of them is Harrison Ford, who I interviewed for Firewall. And let me tell you, there are 1,000 movies on this planet that Harrison Ford would have preferred to discuss than the movie Firewall that day. And the other one was Anne Hathaway, who I won't give specifics, but what I'll say is... we were at a junket at a remote location. They tried to... Oh, there were going to be outdoor setups for the junket. And the weather meant they had to move indoors. And so the production crew was racing against the clock to move everything from the outdoor spot with the great backdrops to a hotel room and get everything set up as quickly as possible. And Anne, to her credit, showed up early to start the day. And but the room wasn't ready at all. Then they were working as hard as they could, you know. And so I got a text message from a studio rep that said, hey, if you're around, can you come down and be around because Anne Hathaway's here and she'd like to start. And so we'd love to line some people up. And so I said, yeah, I got nothing going on. I've had my questions all prepped and rolled down and So she was in the room and they said, "You're first, hop in." And I hopped in and the room wasn't ready. And we tried small talk. She was working on Interstellar at this point. And ooh. So the guy made a joke along the lines of like, we're going quick as we can, but it might be like another 15, 20 minutes. And I said, "Oh, great. All the time in the world, you can tell me everything about Interstellar." And she was like, "No." And I was like, "Oh, all right. Okay. Not in the mood. Not in the mood to play nice. Around." And that was the highlight of our conversation.
Oh, God.
That was the highlight. And it just went, it went downhill relatively fast. And so here's what I'll say is that I, maybe she was just having a bad day, right? Like maybe she just wasn't in the mood to be doing press. And the situation, such as it was, with the tech not being ready and her feeling that she knew better how to set up the room than the other guys, and then her thinking that all of my questions were shit. You know, it's all of those factors leading into one. And I have not done her since that time. And that was my only experience with her. And you guys have said nothing but amazing things about her. And I believe it. Oh, no, that's not true. God, that's not true. I interviewed her for One Day, I think was the name of that movie. And in she was actually, she was great. Yeah, she was great at that. She was great at that junk. She was really kind.
To this Sean's point, by the way, that happens sometimes in the sense of like it's
it does.
Like they're human beings and they have bad days. Like I've gotten Harrison Ford in a really bad mood and I've gotten Harrison Ford in a great mood. So like I always say to myself, if I interview the person more than once and they're better or worse the second time around, it's just I always think of it as just where they are emotionally in that day. Now, yeah, I mean, I mean, again, I don't know what the experience was like for you. I'm sure there was some awkwardness, but I would imagine maybe she was just having a bad day. And then if she was great for you the next time, I don't know. It's fascinating though, because like most of the time I would say that actors, everyone I've ever talked to has generally been really cool. There are just times where people were having a bad day and you can tell it. You know what I mean?
And Kevin too, I mean, and by no means am I trying to put us in the same category as Harrison Ford or Anne Hathaway. But Kevin, don't you find too, like, we get to a lesser degree, obviously, but we get recognized in the streets by nature of what we do. And I mean, it's, I'd like to think that I've been nice to everyone that's come across, as I'm sure you have, Kevin, but like, I'm sure there's someone out there who exists who ran across me on a day where like, maybe I wasn't nice enough, or maybe I didn't respond the way that they wanted me to respond. And that is the entirety of their history with me. So 100% of their knowledge of me in person is maybe me not being the guy that they wanted me to be. I'm just saying that I have like a distinct knowledge of ever being mean to anybody, but like, I'm sure there have been days where I just was just sort of like, Hey, how's it going? And they kind of left it at that. And maybe they wanted more. And I'm sure there's someone out there that, granted, this is running into someone on the street's different than a junket situation, because that's a situation where you should be nice, 100% should be nice to somebody. But yeah, so you never really know really what someone's going through on any particular day.
And I'll give you Anne Hathaway credit. When I asked that question about the tear, she wasn't rude to me about it. I just felt like there was an answer there that I wasn't getting.
Kevin, did you ask her what her favorite Quentin Tarantino movie is?
I did not. What is it?
Oh, it's easily. It's the Hateful Ocean's 8.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good one.
Kevin, you're up. What's your favorite Anne Hathaway movie?
My favorite Anne Hathaway movie, well, my favorite movie she's ever been in is Interstellar, but that's cheating, so I'm not going to go that route. I think my favorite movie she's done outside of Interstellar is Love and Other Drugs. I just love that performance. I love that story. I love her and Jake Gyllenhaal's chemistry. I love that. I just love their relationship, and I love her character, and everything about that film, I fell in love with those two people, and I wanted them to be together. And I don't know, there was something about her character that was so interesting to me. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I just remember being blown away by that particular performance and that particular character and that relationship with Gyllenhaal. I mean, like, it's interesting because like my ultimate go-to for her is going to be Interstellar, but I feel like that's cheating to give that answer, because when I think of Interstellar has, I think of Nolan, I think of Chastain. There's a lot of things I think about, but Love and Other Drugs I key in on. Anne Hathaway.
You know what I love about Kevin McCarthy, and people don't single this out enough? He loves a good romance.
I do like
a good
romance.
He does love a good romance. And he finds romance in movies that aren't on the surface romance.
Django right. Unchained is one of the greatest love stories
Django,
of our time.
Like, yeah,
Django Unchained is one of the greatest love stories of our time. Love that movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's true. So it's true romance.
All right, let's go to some audience picks for Annie Hathaway.
We got a lot of audience picks.
We did get a number of them, and people went all over the board. Now, Yuri agreed with me and said Rachel getting married. A lot of people said Colossal, including Cooper Hood.
I like Colossal.
And Adam Frazier also. Colossal's a really good film. And then Danielle Solzman said Princess Diaries, which also got a number of votes because I think that's probably one of the first times that people got to know Anne Hathaway. For next week, and this ties into, marginally, the fact that Quentin Tarantino is going to be on episode number 77 of Real Blend, but Gabe says we're playing hashtag George Clooney Blend. So you can let us know your
pick.
That's
a good one.
It's a really good one because he's all over the board.
That's a great one.
I think I know mine and it's going to really surprise you guys.
I definitely do not.
It's Batman. So here's how you can let us know your George Clooney picks. You can go to Twitter and use the hashtag George Clooney Blend, and we will search your answers that way. You can also email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. You can go on the iTunes page, and while you're leaving us a review about the show, you can say, hey, by the way, I love George Clooney in this movie, and use the hashtag George Clooney Blend so that we can find it. And then next week, when we come on, we're going to record an episode. We're going to talk about the news of the day. We're going to play George Clooney Blend, and we are going to run our full interview with Quentin Tarantino on the Real Blend podcast. Yes. So until next week, you can find Jake at Jake's Takes. Kevin is found at Kevin McCarthy TV.
I changed my
Kevin,
Twitter
you're getting
handle.
A lot more. You're getting a lot of political people lately. I see you.
Yeah.
You're
my new Twitter handle is Kevin McCarthy TV loves remakes.
Please. All right. Just the way somebody also started, I've interviewed Julia Roberts. Please do Kevin McCarthy TV loves remakes. And I promise you all of the people involved with the show will follow it. I'm at Sean.
I will not. I swear to God, I will not.
Sean_O'Connell.
I feel really bad about Jake and I arguing the way we just did. So I just want to say I'm sorry.
This is what we do.
I just want to apologize.
If we were both tennis players and we met in Wimbledon, would you not walk onto that court and give 110% even though it was your friend on the other side of
that? Of course I would, but before I go to sleep in the next 10 minutes here, I want to apologize and go to sleep on good terms. I'm just really sorry about that.
We will go to sleep saying I love you, I promise you.
Okay.
All right. And
you're still wrong.
The remake of our love is one that is constantly changing, therefore I approve of it.
No, but every day I wake up and our love is remade, and it's the same, and it feels great.
And it's different every day.
I'm okay with it. I'm okay
it's
with
different.
Our love being remade every day. I have no issue with it.
Gabe, for God's sakes, do your job.
Unless Jon Favreau's directing it, in which case it's the same exact love. But then the remakes happen.
And
it'll be soulless.
We have cheese pizza. Yeah, you know.
All right. Don't forget, go to iTunes, drop us a review, give us a star rating. We will be back next week. You guys, believe me, I think you're going to hear one or two teases on social media about next week's episode. The Real Blend interview with Quentin Tarantino. So until then, when we're all back at it again.
D-U-N-K-I-R-K spells Dunkirk.
That's terrifying.
Thank you.